The organized cell. The interior anatomy of the cell. Give me an organic vesicle, cell, endowed with life, and I will give you back whole of the organized world. François Vincent Raspail. Cell biology finally makes possible a century-old dream, that of analysis of diseases at the cellular level, the first step toward their final control. George Palladay. The cell, Rudolf Virchow proposed in 1852, is a closed unit of life that bears within itself the laws governing its existence. To begin with, a bounded, autonomous living unit, a closed unit that bears the laws that govern its existence, must have a boundary. It is the membrane that defines the boundary, the outer limits of the self. Bodies are bound by a multicellular membrane, the skin. So is the psyche by another membrane, the self. And so are houses and nations. To define an internal milieu is to define its edge, a place where the inside ends and the outside begins. Without an edge, there is no self. To be a cell, to exist as cell, it must distinguish itself from its non-self. But what is the boundary of a cell? Where does one cell end and another begin? It also begins and ends with a membrane that surrounds it. The membrane presents a locus of paradoxes. If it is hermetically sealed, allowing nothing in or out, then it will maintain the integrity of its insides. But how, then, might a cell handle the inevitable requirements and liabilities of living? A cell needs pores to permit nutrients to move in and out. It needs docks for signals from the outside to arrive and be processed. What if the organism is starving and the cell must conserve food and halt metabolism? A cell must excrete waste, but again, where or how to make a hatch to get rid of it? Every such opening is an exception to the rule of integrity. After all, a doorway to the outside is also a doorway to the inside. Viruses or other microbes might use the routes of nutrient uptake or waste disposal to enter a cell. Porosity, in short, represents an essential feature of life, but also an essential vulnerability of living. A perfectly sealed cell is a perfectly dead cell, but unsealing the membrane through portals exposes the cell to potential harm. The cell must embrace both, closed to the outside, yet open to the outside. But what are cell membranes made of? In the 1890s, Ernest Overton, a physiologist and incidentally a cousin of Charles Darwin, immersed a variety of cells in hundreds of solutions containing various substances. Chemicals soluble in oil tended to enter the cell, he noted, while those insoluble in oil could not get in. The cell membrane must be an oily layer, Overton concluded, although he could not quite explain how a substance such as an ion or sugar, insoluble in fats, might enter or leave the cell. Overton's observations deepened the mystery. Was the cell membrane thick or thin? Was it made of one layer of fat molecules called lipids, lined in single file, or was it a many-layered structure? The constituents were later further subclassified. The most abundant were particular kinds of lipids that had carried a charged molecule, phosphate, as its head, and a long stretch of carbon as its tail. Additional molecules, such as cholesterol, were also found embedded within the lipid membrane. An ingenious study by two physiologists clarified the topological structure of the cell membrane. In the 1920s, Everett Gorter and François Grendel extracted all the fat from the surface of an exact number of red blood cells, spread the molecules in a single layer, and calculated its surface area. Then they determined the surface area of the cells from which the membranes had been removed. The surface area of the extracted lipids was almost twice the total surface area of the red cells. That number signaled an unexpected truth. A cell membrane must have two layers of lipids. It is a lipid bilayer. Imagine, for a moment, two sheets of paper glued together back to back and then shaped into a three-dimensional object. A balloon, say. If the balloon is the cell, then the two sheets of paper form the bilayered cell membrane. The final piece of the puzzle? how molecules such as sugar or ions pass in and out of the lipid bilayer, and how the cell communicates with its outside, was solved in 1972, nearly 50 years after Gorder and Grendel's experiments. Two biochemists, Garth Nicholson and Seymour Singer, proposed a model in which proteins were embedded, like hatches or channels, crossing the cell membrane. The lipid bilayer was not uniform or monotonous, it was porous by design. Proteins, floating in the membrane and spanning from inside to outside, allowed molecules to permeate the membrane and allowed other proteins and molecules to bind to the outside of the cell. Noting the mosaic-like structure of the membrane, with multiple components stippled together, Nicholson and Singer called this the fluid mosaic model of the cell membrane, a model that electron microscopy then proved to be accurate. A schematic model can be seen in the attached PDF. It's simpler, perhaps, to imagine entering and exploring the interior of a cell as an astronaut might imagine exploring an unfamiliar spacecraft. From far away, you might see the spacecraft's cells' outer contours, the oblong gray-white sphere of an oocyte, or the crimson disk of a red blood cell. As you approach the cell membrane, you might begin to see its outer layer more clearly. Bobbing on that fluid surface are proteins. Some might be receptors for signals, while others might function like molecular glue for attaching one cell to another. Some of these might be channels. If you are fortunate, you might watch a nutrient or an ion slip through the pore and into the cell. And now you, too, might board the craft. You would dive through the hull, that is, into the bilayer membrane, moving rapidly through the space between the two layers, only about 10 nanometers thick, or 10,000 times thinner than a strand of human hair, and emerge inside. Look around and above. Now the inner lamella of the cell membrane would hang above you like the fluid surface of the ocean as seen from below. You would also see the inner parts of the proteins dangling above you like the underbellies of buoys. At first, you might swim through the cell's internal fluid, called either protoplasm, cytoplasm, or cytosol. Protoplasm is the vital fluid that 19th-century biologists discovered in living cells and in living creatures. Indeed, so important is the protoplasm that in the 1850s, a vigorous debate ensued about whether it was the protoplasm and not the cell that should be described as the unitary basis for life. The cell was merely a vessel holding it. The German cell biologist Robert Remak was among the strongest proponents of this idea. Eventually, the cell theorists won, while the protoplasmists admitted a compromised position, maintaining that despite the primacy of the cell, every cell itself contained this vital fluid. The discovery of multiple other organelles within the protoplasm of a cell may have also tempered the idea that the protoplasm was an organism's only necessary and sufficient building block. Although many cell biologists had noted the existence of a fluid within a cell, Hugo von Moll was the first to use the term in the 1840s. The protoplasm is a mind-bogglingly complex soup of chemicals. It is thick and colloidal in some places, watery in others. It is the mother jelly that sustains life. The variations in the physical properties of the protoplasm, watery, semi-fluid, or like dense jelly, have become an increasing area of focus of recent research. Droplet-like accumulations of chemicals suspended within the cell can act as the sites of particular biochemical reactions. The importance of such defined phases, as they are called, in many critical reactions is now well established and is being explored for others. For nearly a half century, after von Moll's work on protoplasm in the 1840s, cell biologists imagined the cell as a liquid balloon filled with a formless, shapeless fluid. But the first thing you might note, once inside the cell, is that the cytoplasm has a molecular skeleton that maintains the form of the cell, just as a bony skeleton maintains an organism's form. In 1904, botanist Nikolai Kolstov was among the first to propose that protoplasm had such an organized internal structure. Kolstov would eventually be proved correct when the various elements of the cytoskeleton were observed by powerful microscopes. This scaffold, termed the cytoskeleton, is composed primarily of filaments of a ropey protein called actin and tubular structures created by a protein called tubulin. Other proteins also contribute to the cellular skeleton. A third type of protein, called the intermediate filament, is also part of the cytoskeleton in some cells. There are more than 70 different kinds of proteins that make up various intermediate filaments. Unlike bones, though, these rope-like structures crisscrossing the cell are neither static nor merely structural. They form an internal system of organization. The cytoskeleton tethers components of the cell together and is required for the movement of the cell. When a white blood cell creeps toward a microbe, it uses actin filaments, among other proteins, to push its feelers forward, gelling and ungelling its front like the ectoplasmic movement of an alien. Bound to the cytoskeleton, or floating in the protoplasmic fluid, are thousands of proteins that make living reactions, respiration, metabolism, waste disposal, possible. As you swim through the protoplasm, you are certain to encounter one particular molecule of critical importance, a long, strand-like molecule called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. RNA strands are made of four subunits: adenine, A, cytosine, C, uracil, U, and guanine, G. One strand might consist of AC, U, GGG, UUU, UU, CC, G, U, C, GGGG, CCC, for thousands of such subunits. The strand carries the message or code to build a protein. RNA has multiple other functions, including regulating the turning of genes on and off, as well as helping in the synthesis of proteins, but we will concentrate on its coding function here. You might imagine it as a set of instructions, a Morse code stretched along a tape. One particular RNA, freshly made in the cell's nucleus, may arrive carrying the instructions to build, say, insulin. Other strands, encoding different proteins, might be floating by. How are these instructions decoded? Look left or right, and you'll spot a massive macromolecular structure called a ribosome, a multi-part assemblage first described by the Romanian-American cell biologist George Palladay in the 1940s. You can't miss it. A liver cell, for instance, contains several million of them. The ribosome captures RNAs and decodes their instructions to synthesize proteins. This cellular protein factory is itself made of proteins and RNA. It is yet another of life's fascinating recursions, in which proteins make it possible to make other proteins. Building proteins is one of the cell's major tasks. Proteins form enzymes that control the chemical reactions of life. They create structural components of the cell. They are the receptors for signals from the outside. They form pores and channels across the membrane and the regulators that switch genes on and off in response to stimuli. Proteins are the workhorses of the cell. You might encounter yet another macromolecular structure, this one shaped like a tubular meat grinder. It is the cell's trash compactor, the proteasome, where proteins go to die. Proteasomes degrade proteins into their constituents and eject the chewed-up pieces back into the protoplasm, completing the cycle of synthesis and breakdown. As you keep swimming through the cell's protoplasm, you are bound to come across a multitude of larger membrane-bound structures. You might imagine each of these as double-walled, enclosed rooms within the spaceship. There's one room for generating power, a room for storage, a room for exporting and importing signals, and another one to discard waste. As microscopists and cell biologists trained their eyes on cells with increasing precision, they found dozens of organized functional substructures, analogous to organs, kidneys, bones, and hearts, that Vesalius and other anatomists had identified in the body. Biologists called them organelles, mini organs found inside cells. Among the first of these structures you're likely to see is a kidney-shaped organelle first described, albeit vaguely, in animal cells in the 1840s by a German histologist named Richard Altman. These organelles, later renamed mitochondria, were found to be the cell's fuel generators. the furnaces that glow and burn constantly to produce the energy needed for life. There is some debate about the origin of mitochondria, but one of the most intriguing and widely accepted theories is that more than a billion years ago, organelles were, in fact, microbial cells that developed the capacity to produce energy via a chemical reaction involving oxygen and glucose. These microbial cells were engulfed or captured by other cells and entered into a working partnership of sorts, a phenomenon termed endosymbiosis. In 1967, evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis described this occurrence in a scientific article titled On the Origin of Mitosing Cells. As Nick Lane explains in The Vital Question, Margulis argued that complex organisms did not evolve by standard natural selection, but by an orgy of cooperation, in which cells engaged with each other so closely that they even got inside each other. Too radical, too early. On the streets of San Francisco and New York, it may have been the summer of love, with young men and women engulfing each other with ardor, but in scientific halls, Margulis's engulfment theory was met with a barrage of skepticism. For her, the summer of endosymbiotic love turned into a long winter of ridicule and rejection, until decades later, when scientists began to note not just the structural similarities between mitochondria and bacteria, but also their molecular and genetic commonalities. Mitochondria are found in all cells, but they are particularly densely packed in cells that need the most energy or that regulate energy storage, such as muscle cells, fat cells, and certain brain cells. They are wrapped around the tails of sperm to provide them enough swimming energy to reach an egg. They divide within the cell, but when it's the cell's turn to reproduce, mitochondria are only split between the two daughter cells. In other words, they have no autonomous life. They can live only within cells. Mitochondria possess their own genes and their own genomes, which suggestively bear some resemblance to the genes and genomes of bacteria. Again, supporting Margulis's hypothesis that they were primitive cells that were engulfed by other cells and then became symbiotic with them. How does a cell generate energy? There are two pathways, one fast and one slow. The fast route occurs mainly in the protoplasm of the cell. Enzymes serially break down glucose into smaller and smaller molecules, and the reaction produces energy. Because the process doesn't use oxygen, it is called anaerobic. In terms of energy, the end product of the fast pathway is two molecules of a chemical called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. ATP is the central currency of energy in virtually all living cells. Any chemical or physical activity that requires energy, for instance, the contraction of a muscle or the synthesis of a protein, utilizes or burns ATP. The deeper slow burn of sugars to produce energy occurs in mitochondria. Bacterial cells lacking mitochondria can use only the first chain of reactions. Here, the end products of glycolysis, literally the chemical breakdown of sugar, are fed into a cycle of reactions that ultimately produce water and carbon dioxide. This cycle of reactions involves the use of oxygen and is therefore called aerobic, and is a small miracle of energy production. It generates a much larger harvest of energy, again, in the form of ATP molecules. The combination of the fast and slow burn nets about the equivalent of 36 ATP molecules from every molecule of glucose. The actual number is slightly lower, since not every reaction is perfectly efficient. Over the course of a day, we generate billions of little canisters of fuel to fire a billion little engines in the billions of cells in our bodies. Should all the billions of gently burning little fires cease to burn, the physical chemist Eugene Rabinowitz wrote, no heart could beat, no plant could grow upward defying gravity, no amoeba could swim, no sensation could speed along a nerve, no thought could flash in the human brain. Next, you might encounter a maze of winding, tortuous pathways, also bound by membranes, that crisscrosses the body of the cell. It is also an organelle and is called the endoplasmic reticulum, although most biologists abbreviate it ER. This structure was first described by the cell biologist Keith Porter and Albert Claude, working closely with George Palladay at the Rockefeller Institute in New York in the late 1940s. The French cytologist Charles Garnier had first observed the endoplasmic reticulum in 1897 using a light microscope, but he did not assign it any particular function. The experiments to delineate the function of this pathway and its centrality to the biology of the cell represent one of the most momentous journeys in science. Palladay's own journey into cell biology had been circuitous. He was born in 1912 in Iași, then called Iași, in Romania. His father, a professor of philosophy, wanted his son to become a philosopher too, but George was drawn to a discipline with more tangibles and specifics. He studied medicine and began his career as a doctor in the capital city of Bucharest. But he was soon lured by cell biology. Like Rudolf Virchow, Palladay also wanted to unify cell biology, cellular pathology, and medicine. It finally makes possible a century-old dream, that of analysis of diseases at the cellular level, the first step toward their final control, he would later write. In the 1940s, Palladay was offered a position as a researcher in New York. His trip to the United States across war-shredded Europe was a harrowing pilgrimage. He traveled through bleak, desolate Poland, where he was detained for weeks awaiting immigration. He thought of himself like a scientific version of the character Christian in The Pilgrim's Progress, a colleague of Palladay's told me, somehow exempt from all the thousands of blockades and pitfalls that might thwart his journey to New York, or, for that matter, into the center of the cell. In 1946, then 34 years old, Palladay finally arrived in New York. He launched his research career at New York University and then took a job at the Rockefeller Institute. He was appointed an assistant professor in 1948 and given a lab in an unattractive dungeon sunk in a third-floor basement of one of the institute's oldest buildings. The dungeon, however unbecoming, proved to be a haven for cell biologists. The new field had virtually no tradition. Everybody working in it came from some other province in natural sciences, Palladay wrote. And so he pulled and borrowed and stole from every branch and province of science, in essence, creating his own discipline, modern cell biology. Palladay launched crucial collaborations with Porter and Claude. The lab would soon become the intellectual basement for the field of subcellular anatomy and function, the plinth on which the towering discipline would be constructed. Just as Robert Hooke and Antony van Leeuwenhoek, peering down a microscope, revolutionized cell biology in the 17th century, Palladay, Porter, and Claude discovered a more abstract way of looking inside the cell. First, they burst cells open and spun the contents in a high-speed centrifuge along a gradient of densities. As the centrifuge spun with dizzying velocity, pulling down the cell's heaviest subparts to the bottom and leaving lighter subparts above, different components of the cell appeared at different gradients along the length of a tube. Each component could then be extracted from a particular part of the tube and assessed separately to identify its structural anatomy and the biochemical reactions contained within it. Reactions such as oxidation, synthesis, detoxification, and waste disposal. And then, by sectioning the cell into the thinnest slices and training an electron microscope on them, researchers could retrace these components and reactions to their locations in animal cells. This, too, was seeing, but with two kinds of lenses. There was, on one hand, the abstract lens of biochemistry, the centrifugal separation of subcellular components, and the discovery of chemical reactions and components confined to them. And on the other hand, there was the physical lens of electron microscopy, which assigned these chemical functions to anatomical structures and locations within cells. Palladay described this coalescence of the two ways of seeing as a pendulum that swung from microscopic anatomy to functional anatomy and back again. Structure, as traditionally envisaged by the microscopist, was bound to merge into biochemistry, and biochemistry of subcellular components appeared to be the best way to get at the function of some of the newly discovered structures. It was a ping-pong match in which both sides won. Microscopists would see subcellular structures, biochemists would assign functions to them. Or biochemists would find a function and then turn to microscopists to pinpoint the structure responsible for that function. Using this method, Palladay, Porter, and Claude entered the luminous heart of the cell. Let's return to the endoplasmic reticulum, the winding pathway found in virtually every cell. There is a voluptuousness to this structure, the sheer excess of it, running lace over lace like folded pleats. Looking through an extraordinarily powerful microscope at cells from a dog's pancreas revealed the outer edges of the ER membrane studded with tiny, dense particles. See the illustration in the attached PDF. An abundance of structures, but what do they all do? Palladay asked. From the work of prior researchers, he knew that the ER was associated with synthesizing and exporting proteins, which carry out virtually all the work of the cell. Some, like enzymes responsible for metabolizing glucose, are synthesized within a cell and stay there to perform their functions. But other proteins, insulin, say, or digestive enzymes, are secreted by cells into the blood or the intestines. And yet, other proteins, such as receptors and pores, are inserted into the cell membrane. But how does a protein reach its destination? In 1960, Palladay and his co-workers, Philip Sikovits in particular, used radioactivity, a molecular beacon, to label proteins in a cell and then follow their progress over time. He would pulse the cell with a high dose of radioactivity, thereby labeling all the proteins being synthesized, and then chase the protein's location using the electron microscope to visualize the progress of these proteins. Reassuringly, he found the radioactive signal first associated with ribosomes, the site where proteins were initially synthesized. Ribosomes were the tiny, dense particles that Palladay had seen studying the edges of the ER. Then, to his wonderment, some of the proteins moved from the ribosomes into the endoplasmic reticulum. In the years following Palladay's discovery, Sabatini and a German immigrant named Günter Blobel made one of the most seminal discoveries about how proteins are targeted either to the ER for secretion out of the cell or for insertion in the cell membrane. In short, a signal directing a protein destined for secretion or destined to the membrane is already appended in the protein sequence, like a postage stamp. Specific cellular pathways recognize this stamp and direct the protein to its predetermined destination. The more detailed version is this. Sabatini and Blobel, a biologist, found that secreted and membrane-resident proteins carry this specific signal, a sequence of amino acids in their sequences. As the ribosome decodes the RNA and synthesizes a protein, a molecular complex called the signal recognition particle, SRP, recognizes this targeting signal and drags the protein toward the ER. A pore crossing from the cell into the ER enables the transport of the protein into the ER. Please see the illustrations in the attached PDF. Over time, as he chased the protein's pilgrimage, Palladay found it moving through the ER and then into a specialized compartment called the Golgi apparatus, a structure first seen but never ascribed a function by Italian microscopist Camillo Golgi in 1898. From there, the labeled proteins traveled to secretory granules that budded off the Golgi and then to their final stop. Ejected out of the cell, the biologists James Rothman, Randy Scheckman, and Thomas Suthoff pioneered the study of how proteins that are not bound for export end up in their right locations within the cell. The trio of scientists won the 2013 Nobel Prize for this work on the intracellular trafficking of proteins. At almost each point in their journey, some of the proteins are modified. They can be clipped short, chemically modified by the addition of a sugar, or twirled around and bound to another protein. The signals to make these modifications are typically contained in the sequence of the protein itself. The whole process can be imagined as an elaborate postal system. It begins with the linguistic code of genes, RNA, that is translated to write the letter, the protein. The protein is written or synthesized by the cell's letter writer, the ribosome, which then posts it to the mailbox, the pore by which the protein enters the ER. The pore routes it to the central posting station, the endoplasmic reticulum, which then sends the letter to the sorting system, the Golgi, and finally brings it to the delivery vehicle, the secretory granule. There are, in fact, even codes appended to proteins, stamps, that enable the cell to determine their ultimate destination. This postal system, Palladay realized, is how most proteins get to their correct locations within the cell. The pioneering studies of Palladay, Porter, and Claude threw open a new world of subcellular anatomy. The twinning of two ways of seeing, microscopy and biochemistry, was synergistic. As biologists used these methods on cells, they found dozens of such functional, anatomically defined subcellular structures. The Belgian biologist Christian de Duve, yet another Rockefeller Institute scientist, discovered an enzyme-laden structure called a lysosome. Like a cellular stomach, it digests worn-out cellular parts, as well as invading bacteria and viruses. Plant cells contain structures called chloroplasts, the sites of photosynthesis, the conversion of light into glucose. Chloroplasts, like mitochondria, carry their own DNA, again suggesting an origin in microbes that were engulfed by other cells. There is a membrane-bound structure called a peroxisome, another of de Duve's discoveries, where some of life's most dangerous reactions, for instance the oxidation of molecules, is sequestered, and where hydrogen peroxide, an intensely reactive chemical, is generated. Were the peroxisome to open up and release its internal poisons, the cell would be attacked by its own reactive contents. It is the chalice, filled with poisons to metabolize other poisons, that the cell keeps carefully closed. I've reserved for last the most essential and still the most mysterious of organelles, the nucleus. Bacteria don't possess nuclei, but in cells that do, all plant and animal cells including human cells, the nucleus is where the bulk of the cell's genetic material, the instruction manual for life, is stored. It is the storage bank for DNA, for the genome. The nucleus is the command center, the captain's bridge of the cell. It is the place that both receives and then disseminates most of life's signals. RNA, the code to build proteins, is copied from the genetic code here and then exported out of the nucleus. We might imagine the nucleus as the center of life. The cellular anatomist Robert Brown observed the nucleus in orchid cells in 1836. Noting its central position in the cell, he named the structure after the Greek word for kernel. Yet its function, or its vitality to the function of the cell, would remain unknown for an entire century. Like all cells, the nucleus is surrounded by a porous two-layered membrane, although its pores are far less characterized or known. The nucleus, as I mentioned before, houses the organism's genome, made of long stretches of deoxyribonucleic acid. The DNA double helix is elaborately folded and packaged around molecules called histones, and tightened and wound further into structures called chromosomes. If a single cell's DNA could be stretched out straight, like a wire, it would measure 6.5 feet. And if you could do that for every cell in the human body and laid all of that DNA end to end, it would stretch from the earth to the sun and back again more than 60 times. String together all the DNA in every human being on the planet, and it would reach the Andromeda galaxy and back nearly 2.5 times. The nucleus, like the cell's inner liquid, the cytoplasm, is also organized, although we still know little about its organizational structure. Scientists studying the nucleus believe that it contains its own skeleton made of molecular fibers. Proteins, traversing the cytoplasm, enter through the pores of the nuclear membrane and bind to the DNA and turn genes on and off. Hormones, bound to proteins, traffic in and out. ATP, the universal source of energy, moves swiftly through the pores. The process of switching genes on and off is vital, giving the cell its identity. The set of on-off genes instructs a neuron to be a neuron and a white cell to be a white cell. During the development of an organism, genes, or rather proteins encoded by genes, tell cells about their relative positions and command their future fates. Genes are turned on and off by external stimuli such as hormones, which also signal changes in a cell's behavior. When a cell divides, every chromosome is copied, and the two copies separate in space. In human cells, the nuclear envelope dissolves. One full set of chromosomes migrates to each of the two newborn daughter cells, and the nuclear membrane reappears around them, in essence, regenerating a daughter cell with a new nucleus and chromosomes lodged inside it. Yet, much of the nucleus remains a mystery. The doors to the command center of the cell are still partially closed. As one biologist put it, "We can only hope that what the geneticist J.B.S. Haldane posited on the cosmos will prove not to be true for the nucleus." Now my suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. If we appropriately bear in mind that the nucleus may be more complicated than we may have once thought, and yet just may be knowable, then this very belief may empower us and our students and successors to penetrate the subject's awaiting depths, the next of which now beckon. There is every reason to believe in this program, so let us be of good cheer. Membrane, protoplasm, lysosome, peroxisome, nucleus. The subunits of the cell that we've met are vital to its existence. They perform specialized functions that allow a cell to possess and maintain an independent life. Their location, organization, and orchestration are crucial. In short, a cell's autonomy lies in its anatomy. And that autonomy, in turn, enables an essential feature of living systems, the capacity to maintain the fixity of an internal milieu, a phenomenon termed homeostasis. The concept of homeostasis, the word is derived from the Greek words homeo and stasis, loosely meaning related to stillness, was first described by the French physiologist Claude Bernard in the 1870s and further developed by the Harvard University physiologist Walter Cannon in the 1930s. For generations before Bernard and Cannon, physiologists had described animals as assemblages of machines, sums of dynamic parts. Muscles were motors, the lungs a pair of bellows, the heart a pump. Pulsing, swiveling, pumping, physiology's emphasis was on movement, on actions, on work. Don't just stand there, do something. Bernard inverted that logic. La fixité du milieu, intérieur et la condition de la vie libre indépendante. The constancy of the interior environment is the condition of free and independent life, Bernard wrote in 1878. In shifting physiology's focus from action to the maintenance of fixity, Bernard changed our conception of how an organism's body works. A major point of physiological activity, paradoxically, was to enable stasis. Don't just do something, stand there. Bernard and Cannon studied homeostasis in organisms and organs, but it is increasingly recognized as a fundamental feature of cells and, indeed, of life. To understand cellular homeostasis, we begin, again, with the membrane that separates the cell from its external milieu so that its internal reactions can be sequestered and self-contained. The membrane has also evolved pumps to move unwanted substances out of the cell, again, to maintain a constancy in the cell's internal space. The protoplasm contains chemical buffers, so that the acidity or the alkalinity of the cell does not change, even when the chemical environment outside the cell changes. A cell needs energy, and the mitochondria deliver. The proteasome disposes of unwanted or misfolded proteins. Specialized storage organelles in some cells ensure that a supply of nutrients can act as a backup repository should there be a shortage externally. Toxic byproducts of metabolism are shepherded to the peroxisome to be destroyed. We will soon move from autonomy and homeostasis to other fundamental features of the cell: reproduction, functional specialization, and the cell's capacity to divide and form multicellular organisms. But linger with me for a moment to mark the extraordinary discoveries that this chapter covers. The two decades between 1940 and 1960 may rank as the most fertile and productive period for cell biologists seeking to dissect the functional anatomy of the cell's interior. There's a majesty and mastery in these decades, similar to the majesty and mastery that dates to almost exactly a century prior, when Schwann, Schleiden, Virchow, and others laid the foundations of cell biology. If the insights revealed during this period seem routine today, some version of the phrase, "the mitochondria are the cell's energy factory," can inevitably be found in every high school science textbook, it's because we've forgotten, as we often do, the spine-tingling awe that each of these discoveries generated in its time. I don't think it's hyperbolic to describe the transitions from the discovery of the cell to the revelation of its structural anatomy and, finally, to the elucidation of its functional anatomy as one of science's most inspiring achievements. The discovery of functional anatomy enabled an integrated view of the cell and, by extension, of the defining features of life. A cell, as noted before, is not just a system of parts sitting next to parts, just as a car is not a carburetor sitting next to an engine. It is an integrating machine that must amalgamate the functions of these individual parts to enable the fundamental features of life. Between 1940 and 1960, scientists began to integrate the separate parts of the cell to understand how an autonomous living unit might function and become living. Inevitably, these fundamental discoveries eventually launched the development of new medicines. If gross anatomy and physiology had launched a new era for surgery and medicine in the 18th and 19th centuries, functional cellular anatomy and physiology announced new loci for disease and therapeutic intervention in the 20th century. The functional breakdown of an organ we have long known causes a disease. The kidney fails, the heart weakens, bones fracture. But what of the functional breakdown of a cellular organelle? In the summer of 2003, an 11-year-old hockey player named Jared began to lose vision in both his eyes. The world was dimming, slowly, and Jared, trying his best to keep playing sports, struggled to find the lines on the hockey ice surface. His parents brought him to an ophthalmologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, New York, to obtain a diagnosis. A week later, the clinic uncovered the source. Jared had a condition called Leber Hereditary Optic Neuropathy, LHON. "I'm so very sorry, but Jared will be blind," the ophthalmologist at the Mayo informed Jared's parents gently. Typically, the inherited illness arises out of a mutation in a gene named MTND4 that is found in the mitochondria. The culprit gene was found and mapped in 1988, just 2 years before the launch of the Human Genome Project. For reasons still unknown, it specifically affects the function of the eye's retinal ganglion cell, which transmits information from the retina to the optic nerve and onward to the brain. In affected children, the disease progresses inexorably. At first, the nerve fibers along the optic disc begin to bloat. Then the optic nerve atrophies and the retinal nerves become thin and dull in appearance. Jared had inherited the most common LHON mutation in nucleotide position 11778 in the mitochondrial genome, which is about 16,000 bases long in total. Mitochondrial mutations are special because they can be inherited only from your mother, while most other mutations can come from either parent. Mitochondria don't have an autonomous existence. They can live only inside cells. They divide when a cell divides and then are apportioned to the two daughter cells. When an egg cell forms in the mother, all its mitochondria are from her cells. Upon fertilization, the sperm cell injects its DNA into the egg, but not any mitochondria. Therefore, every mitochondrion that you are born with is maternal in origin. The mutation in the MTND4 gene that Jared inherited had to come from his mother. It is likely that it occurred by chance during the creation of the egg because his mother did not have the disease. 11778, Jared wrote in his diary. "I wish this had been the combination to my hockey locker or bike lock or even to my school locker. Instead, it was to be the combination to a genetic mutation at nucleotide position 11778 that would unlock the disease in my body at the age of 11 and would ultimately change my life forever. Blind? What the hell was blind? I'm 11 years old. I'm a hockey player. I dig chicks and they dig me. I've got a lot of friends and no worries. Blind? What do they mean I won't be able to see? Not to be able to see what? Just fix it, Dad, and let me go play with my buddies. But Dad, try as he might, could not fix it. Jared's ganglion cells began to decay. Cannily, the parents turned Jared's attention to playing the guitar. He learned to play by touch and sound alone, and while the blindness advanced, gradually but relentlessly, so did his music. So here I am at the Musicians Institute in Los Angeles, California, 8 years after playing my first ear-piercing concert for my mother and father in Guitar Center. I believe I'm the first blind student that has attended this remarkable music institution, which is pretty cool. I guess they believed I was good enough to keep up with all the other students who were required to read music. Jared had lost sight, but found sound. In 2011, a group of ophthalmologists in Hubei, China, modified a virus called AAV2 to carry the normal version of the ND4 gene. The virus infects human and primate cells but doesn't cause any overt or acute disease, and it can be modified to carry a foreign gene such as ND4. Millions of gene-modified virus particles were suspended in a droplet of liquid. A tiny needle pierced the edge of the patient's cornea and deposited the drop of dense viral soup into the vitreous layer just above the retina. The scientists knew they were treading on dangerous, tripwired territory. In September 1999, Jesse Gelsinger, a teenager with a mild metabolic disease that affected his liver's ability to metabolize byproducts of protein degradation, resulting in near-toxic levels of ammonia in his blood, had been infused with a gene-modified adenovirus. The boy's doctors had hoped that the transfusion of the virus and experimental therapy would cure Jesse's illness. Tragically, though, Jesse suffered a catastrophic immune reaction to the virus, quickly resulting in fatal organ failure. The fallout from his death was immediate. For the first decade of the 21st century, the field of gene therapy was forced into a deep winter. Few researchers attempted to deliver gene-modified viruses into humans, and regulators bound the field with stringent rules. But the retina is a special site. Not only is a raindrop's worth of virus sufficient to infect the cells, but also the retina is uniquely immune-privileged. Along with a few other places in the body, the testes among them, it is not actively surveyed by an immune response and therefore highly unlikely to generate a severe reaction to an infectious agent. Furthermore, the gene therapy vectors had improved vastly since the Gelsinger saga, bolstering scientists' confidence that the gene could be delivered without provoking an adverse reaction. In 2011, Chinese physicians enlisted 8 patients with LHON for a small clinical trial. There were early signs of success. The virus bore the genes into the retinal ganglion cells, and the cells synthesized the correct ND4 protein, which found its way to the mitochondria. Over the next 36 months, visual acuity improved in 5 of the 8 patients. The studies are continuing as I write this, with the researchers refining the nature of the patients enrolled and extending the observation period. The viral product, now called Lumivoc, is currently in late-phase clinical trials for LHON patients with early vision loss. In May 2021, trialists reported the completion of the RESCUE trial, in which gene therapy was used to halt the progressive loss of vision in patients with the mutation within 6 months of their visual impairment. The placebo-controlled, double-blinded, multi-centered, and randomized trial, a gold standard study, involved 39 subjects. One patient received a lower dose of the virus, leaving 38 evaluable patients. One eye was injected with the virus, while the other was treated with a sham injection containing no virus. At 24 weeks, both the treated and control untreated groups continued to demonstrate the inevitable decline in visual acuity. The vision loss plateaued in both eyes at 48 weeks, but at 96 weeks, surprisingly, both the treated and untreated eyes in about 3/4 of the treated subjects showed significant improvements in acuity. The trial was thus both a success and a mystery. While the eye treated with gene therapy was expected to improve, why did the untreated eye also improve? Is there some interconnection between retinal ganglion cells or some other mechanism of connection across two eyes that we don't know about? Did the virus leak into the circulation and affect the other eye? Unfortunately, for patients such as Jared, who have lost their vision completely, the replacement of ND4 is unlikely to be of benefit. For them, it is too late to restore vision. When the responsive cells have died, the replacement of the function of an organelle can no longer be of benefit. An organelle can function only in the context of the right cell. If the trials continue apace and the benefits prove to be long-term, still a big if, Lumovac will eventually find its place in the medical pharmacopoeia. But the launching of a cell-modifying therapy that attempts to change mitochondrial function has already signaled a new direction for medicine. In the 1950s and 1960s, medicine and surgery witnessed an explosion of organ-directed therapies, rerouting blood vessels in a heart to bypass a blockage or replacing a diseased kidney with a transplanted organ. A new universe of drugs emerged: antibiotics, antibodies, chemicals to prevent blood clots or reduce cholesterol. But this is organelle-directed therapy, the replenishment of a functional deficiency in the mitochondrion of a retinal ganglion cell. It represents the culmination of decades of study of cellular anatomy, the dissection of subcellular compartments, and the characterization of their dysfunction in diseased states. It is gene therapy, of course, but also cell therapy in situ. In other words, the restoration of function of a diseased cell in its native anatomical location in the human body.